I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
So Missouri exemplifies what you see in Oklahoma, what we've seen in Texas. You get a rabid prosecutor who wants to cut notches on his belt.
We need access to information about the drugs in Missouri, where they came from, what pharmacy was involved, and how they plan to be used.
If someone viciously and brutally murdered a loved one of yours, a child, a spouse, a parent, could you get past rage and grief to forgive? Or even just to accept? I'm not sure I could. Unless we've experienced such a loss, how could any of us ever know for sure? I hope I never have to find out. But as citizens, don't we all have an obligation to consider the issue? Society has to deal with such. Otherwise, we leave it to surviving loved ones to forgive or not, to act in kind in retribution or not. Today on Tell Somebody, Dead Man Walking author Sister Helen Prejean and Stacy Pratt, State Coordinator for Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody for November 5th, 2015, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at TellSomebodyNow, and like the Facebook page, facebook.com/TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. Missouri death penalty issues have been much in the news in the last year or two. A February 10, 2014 special hearing held by the Missouri House Committee on Government Oversight and Accountability was covered in an article by the Missouri Times, www.missouritimes.com, who wrote that Missouri Department of Corrections Director George Lombardi confirmed that, because of difficulties in finding suppliers for the three-drug cocktail it used to use for executions, Missouri purchases its execution drugs in cash through a department official from a compounding pharmacy in Oklahoma. The official takes $11,000 in cash to Oklahoma in person and then hand delivers the new drug, pentobarbital, to the department. The article said that attorney Jacob Luby of the Death Penalty Litigation Center contended that this effectively turned state employees into drug mules. First, let's address the fact that this drug is supposed to be kept frozen and not at room temperature, Luby was quoted as saying. We've got someone driving a drug across state lines after purchasing it in cash and delivering it to the department, and until a few weeks ago we didn't even know who was selling us the drug. The article also mentioned two former Missouri death row inmates, Alan Nicholson and Martin Schulz, both of whom were executed while their cases were still technically pending before a federal judge. Wow. Though executions are trending down nationally, Missouri carried out 10 executions in 2014, leading the nation on a per capita basis. In a surprise announcement on October 2nd this year, Governor Nixon commuted the death sentence of Kimber Edwards, who had been scheduled to be executed just days later on October 6th. Governor Nixon did not explain his decision, even saying that he was convinced the evidence supports the jury's decision to convict Kimber Edwards of first-degree murder. But Nixon's decision came after international press accounts about coerced testimony, recanted confession, allegations of frame-up, and with the involvement of the Innocence Project. Dead Man Walking author Sister Helen Prejean returned to Kansas City last Friday, October 30th, sponsored by Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty and by the Center for Global Studies and Social Justice at Abilene University. Sister Helen spoke at Abilene in South Kansas City in the afternoon and at Unity on the Plaza in the evening. In between, I went to Abilene and caught a few minutes with her after speaking for a few minutes with the state coordinator for Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, Stacy Pratt. Give a listen. I'm here now with Stacy Pratt, state coordinator for Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Stacy Pratt, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Briefly talking to Sister Helen Prejean on the phone this afternoon, she noted that Missouri is now leading the pack in the United States for exercising the death penalty. Is that right?
That's exactly right. We are the number one executor in the United States right now, if you look at it on a per capita basis. The Atlantic and the Washington Post actually both called that out this summer. So it's a crisis in Missouri. We are killing people at an incredible rate. We see in many situations where the court will set an execution date every month, and we fight those tooth and nail, but we are in a state of crisis in Missouri.
I found something online. I think it was out of date because it was a list of names of those currently on death row in Missouri, and I know one of them has already been executed. But how many are there now?
There are about 30 on death row right now.
Forgive me, I forget the name. I'm sure you're familiar with it. This was, there were two young men who had murdered a 15-year-old girl. I believe they're both executed now, one very recently, one a year or two ago. Tell me a little bit about that story.
Let's see, which you're referring to the most recent executions that involved, I think there was an abduction of a young woman, is that right?
Yeah, there was a 15-year-old girl some years ago. These things, as you know better than most of us, take a long time to wend their way through the courts. But she was exactly where she was supposed to be, waiting for a school bus to take her to school. These two men abducted her, raped her, and then had, as I recall, a discussion about what should we do now. We don't want her to identify us. So they, I think, both took knives and stabbed her to death.
Yeah, I would say this. You know, there are many heinous acts that we suffer in society, and they cause us grievous pain. And there are no words to bring back the young woman or to address the pain that her family must suffer. At the same time, I believe we are a society that's committed to being just and committed to being humane and merciful. I do know that the gentleman who was most recently put to death took full responsibility for his actions. He was high on cocaine. That doesn't make his behavior appropriate or excusable in any way, but it's certainly a situation that calls to mind the possibility of taking responsibility for our actions and achieving redemption. He was a father. He acknowledged immediately the inappropriateness of his behavior. And I think we also have to look at ourselves as people. When we see something heinous, our first instinct, all of us, is to feel rage. It is to say, we must do something. We must take vengeance for this pain that we see. But I think the next thought must be, do we live in a society that allows us to feel more deeply and be more deeply, more than just our primal instincts? And do we want a government that has the power to take life? So those are the situations that I think call on us to move beyond our initial instinct for rage and say, I do not want blood on my hands, and I do not want to change the person that I am to embrace violence. We have an option in Missouri for life in prison without parole. It is completely meaningful. If a person is sentenced to that, they will not leave jail. And so I think that's the better approach. We are going to have heinous crimes in our society, and they break our hearts. But we also have to look at the larger context. In Missouri, we have a case of people of color being disproportionately sentenced to death, and it takes on a racial dimension. University of North Carolina professor Frank Baumgartner has recently revealed that if you are a perpetrator of a crime in which a white person, particularly a white female person, is murdered, you are 14 times more likely to receive the death penalty than if you kill an African-American man. At the time of this heinous crime, there was a serial killer afoot in the African-American community in Kansas City. It's the same geographic location that this crime took place. This individual, who was African-American, killed and raped 6 African-American women, brutally. He received life without parole in a plea deal. They didn't even consider going for death. I don't think death is ever appropriate, but when it happens on a racially biased basis, that must make us call into question why a particular person is sentenced to death.
These disproportionate results racially, Missouri's kind of in step with most of the rest of the country, or no?
Well, no. I think Missouri is an especially egregious case. I don't think every state rises to the level of racial problems that we face in Missouri. I think Missouri demonstrates its history as a former slave state and a state that has an ugly history of lynching, as well as a tradition in St. Louis County of having prosecutors openly strike all African Americans from jury pools, so that you have all white juries examining the guilt or innocence of African American men, often resulting in inappropriate convictions. I believe this was a factor in Kimber Edwards' conviction. He is an innocent man who almost went to our death chamber. And that happened within this very month. So, no, I think Missouri has a particularly ugly history when it comes to race. And to have this level of disproportionality, when you look at death row, the majority of our inmates are African American, even though African Americans constitute a very small percentage of our population. It's disproportionate. And I think that forces us to really look at the message of Black Lives Matter. We are a state that is infamous for not recognizing the value of Black lives in the street and behind prison doors. So it's a history and a current reality that we must acknowledge and address.
A lot of people you talk to, the playing field was even with emancipation in the 1860s, and what do they keep whining about? That doesn't fly with you.
I think that it's important to look at our history and be honest about our history. After emancipation in the 1860s, slavery just took another form. We had sharecropping systems. We had systems of Jim Crow that ensured that people of color had no real opportunities for economic growth. They were denied access to the voting booth. I would say to you, the Civil War did not end until 1964 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So, no, we have systematically ensured that people of color have not had equal access to opportunity. And I think, just as anyone engages in a behavior that causes suffering, we must acknowledge our role in creating that dynamic in Missouri and make amends. and make for a society that is just and equal. You know, that is what we have believed as a society from day one, equal justice under the law. And that means for all people. And we have not achieved that ideal. And so we must make amends.
And this, I don't think, should in any way refute your positions on racial discrimination, but it has a lot to do with economics. A lot of poor whites don't get a fair shake either, do they?
I think if you look at death row, poverty is one of the commonalities. If you are in a position where you cannot afford an attorney, unfortunately, more often than not, you're in a situation where you have someone representing you who is overworked and underpaid. And even if they have the greatest devotion to your case, they do not often have the time or experience in order to defend you adequately. Poverty is a huge factor. And in our country, it's one that is a determining factor in leading to death. Rich people are not on death row. We have a different system of justice if you're poor.
There is a lot in the news, both nationally and in Missouri, about the drugs used to, you know, to use the term they use with dogs, to put people to sleep. What's going on with that nationally and in Missouri? Can you fill us in on that?
The controversy over the drugs used in lethal injection is very serious. And I have to start first with your phrasing of put to sleep. That brings to mind kind of a soft and gentle process. And this is anything but that. People are basically paralyzed so that we cannot witness their suffering. And, you know, in Oklahoma and other states, we've seen people screaming, "I'm being burned alive." So I think we have to start with the reality that we're not just gently putting people to sleep. We are killing them and they are suffering. One of the challenges we find is that in many cases, states are performing human experimentation. They have no idea sometimes which drugs they're using or how the drugs are going to interact with the person. They're using compounds inappropriately or with the wrong mixture of drugs so that we're ending up with individuals who are mummified or suffer greatly in the process. Missouri is one that has a stockpile of lethal injection drugs. We have for a long time maintained we need access to information regarding the sourcing of those materials and what they constitute. The veil of secrecy over the process is one that is problematic. I personally believe that democracy and justice thrive in sunshine. It is behind closed doors that we often see the most egregious examples of abuse. So I think we need access to information about the drugs in Missouri, where they came from, what pharmacy was involved, and how they plan to be used.
I guess one issue generally is that a lot of, and tell me if I've got this right, European producers refuse to sell these drugs, which I guess have other purposes, but they refuse to sell them to the United States to be used in for the death penalty.
That's exactly right. Europe is ahead of us. The people of Europe witnessed the horror associated with a government having the power to kill its own citizens. The Holocaust in Germany, the cost of World War II in human lives woke people up. And they said, we do not believe in the death penalty. We do not believe you can trust the state with that kind of power. You know, we all have questions about the role of government, but I would say no government is responsible enough to be able to execute individuals fairly or with justice. It simply does not exist. So Europe has said, we will not support this. And if we discover that the drugs are being used for executions, we're cutting off your supply. And I think that is completely appropriate.
And do we even know in the case of Missouri if they're using some of those, or is this all locked up?
That's what we're trying to find out. You know, we've had litigation in Missouri that requires a disclosure of who the pharmaceutical company is. So far, we haven't seen compliance with that court order. So that's information we have a right to know.
And you mentioned Oklahoma and instances of obvious
what I think most reasonable people would call cruel and unusual. Do we know in some of those instances exactly what they were using, or is that secret too?
I think each state varies in terms of what they're using, but we have access to some information from those states. I think Sister Helen could probably speak to that more than I can.
Missourians for alternatives to the death penalty. You mentioned solid life without parole. Am I missing anything else on the plural of alternatives?
No. What we mean is that there are other ways to seek justice. There are other ways to seek redemption as society, and there are other ways to seek public safety. You know, the cost of the death penalty is profound. On average, death penalty cases cost about $1.3 to $5 million. It only costs $400,000 to keep someone in prison for the rest of their life. So when you think about that, how many police officers could we hire with that money? How many early childhood education programs should we invest in? We believe in the alternative of investing in the safety of society instead of capital punishment.
And we've talked a little bit about people that are indisputably guilty of heinous crimes. Talk a little bit more about people who were innocent and got off death row. Do we know how many? Maybe we didn't find out.
That's a great question. On a national level, 150 people have gotten off death row, have been exonerated, over about 1,500. So that's pretty significant. In Missouri, we have 4 documented cases of people off death row because they were innocent. Kimber Edwards, most recently this very month, is an innocent man who was almost executed. And those are just the ones we catch. This year, the Missouri Supreme Court decided to stay the execution of Marcellus Williams in January because they had never tested the DNA evidence at the crime scene. For all we know, he's an innocent man. The problem is the system of justice is not perfect by any means, not even close. I think in many ways it's fundamentally broken in Missouri. Given that, with the innocence that exists, that's been demonstrated, we must question the death penalty. We are killing innocent people, and so that's something that we really must pause and think about.
How did you get involved with this organization and in your current position, and tell us more about the organization generally?
I joined the organization in January of this year. I've been devoted to civil rights issues for all of my career. I've worked on Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual problems in a variety of settings. And we have a vision. We believe that within the next 2 or 3 years, there's a real chance to end the death penalty. But it requires the active engagement of citizens who make their voices heard and explain that they do not agree with Missouri's path, that it is broken, it is arbitrary, and it is unfair. So our goal is to reach out to people, have them join us, have them raise their voices. I have always believed that silence is consent. And so in Missouri, we all have blood on our hands as we rush to execute a person a month.
The hottest place in hell reserved for some of us in that regard, I've heard.
It's hard to know.
hard to prove. Can you tell me a little bit more about your background that led you to this point?
Sure. Prior to joining MADP, I was the legal director for the ACLU of Nevada. I litigated Eighth Amendment cases, cruel and unusual punishment cases, in the context of women's prisons. I worked on a case where a woman was ankle shackled during labor and delivery when she was having her child. She had shackles across her ankle, 12 inches connected, and she had to wear those throughout the process of labor and delivery. So we sued, we won, we changed that practice, but what really struck me is how many people were involved in that process. How many people insisted on keeping her ankle shackles on, even though she was going through labor and delivery, when the nurses and the doctors begged them to remove them, when they said this will interfere with the birth process. But people continued on the path. And I think it's a call to wake up. We can participate in things that are morally objectionable. things that lead to the taking of life and are not a show of mercy. But I think we can do better. We can wake up and say, no, I will not see a woman ankle shackled while she delivers her child. And no, I don't think the state of Missouri should take life when we see that it's racially disproportionate, when we see the taking of innocent life, and we recognize the value of all life. That is what, at the end of the day, I think it comes down to. Who are we as people? Are we willing to take a life? I say no.
If somebody listening to you wants to get involved like you did, what would you suggest? What's your website? How can they get involved? And sounds like you're an attorney. Who do you need? Not just attorneys, I assume.
No, we need everyone. We need voices, and the voices of all people and everyone in Missouri. So I welcome folks to come to our website, madpmo.org, and you can sign up to get our newsletter. You can join local chapters. We have chapters in 5 different locations throughout the state. And engage your voice. Call the governor for the fact that on November 3rd, we're set to execute a man who has an IQ of 67. Voice your outrage. Voice your concerns. Begin to question things. Begin to engage in a dialogue on the death penalty with your friends, with the people around you. Your voice matters, and it can make a difference.
About to execute somebody with an IQ of 67. Wasn't there a Supreme Court ruling on that saying no?
Absolutely. The U.S. Supreme Court has prohibited executing individuals with intellectual disabilities, particularly those in situations like this where the IQ is 67. All the same, Ernest Lee Johnson faces execution on November 3rd. Sadly, there is a disconnect between what the overall rules are and the reality of how those things are implemented on the ground. So we are set to violate the constitutional standard, and we need to speak out.
Give us the website again and any other final thoughts you have.
Our website is www.madpmo.org. And this is more than anything an invitation. We need to act together. There is a place in this debate for people who are willing to talk and consider. And more than anything, you know, when the U.S. Supreme Court looks at the death penalty, they look at the evolving standards of decency across the land. And I think the best demonstration of that are the voices of individual people. So your voice matters, and raise it with us.
Okay. Well, Stacy Pratt, thank you very much for talking to us on Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Again, that was Stacy Pratt, State Coordinator for Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. An update, that conversation was recorded on Friday, October 30th. Ms. Pratt mentioned the case of Ernest Johnson, the man with the IQ of 67, set to be executed this past Tuesday, November 2nd. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court put the execution on hold while a lower court considers an appeal claiming Missouri's execution drug could cause him painful seizures due to part of a brain tumor remaining after surgery that removed part of the tumor and about 20% of Johnson's brain tissue. As I understand it, the U.S. Supreme Court stay does not address another appeal claiming that he shouldn't be executed because of mental disability, even though they had ruled in 2001 that executing the mentally disabled was unconstitutional. Also, the case I discussed with Stacy Pratt and couldn't remember the names, in 1989, 15-year-old Ann Harrison was waiting for a school bus in front of her Kansas City area house when she was kidnapped by Roderick Nunley and Michael Taylor. She was raped, sodomized, and then stabbed to death with kitchen knives so that she wouldn't be alive to identify her kidnapper rapists. Michael Taylor was executed in 2014. Roderick Nunley was executed last September. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clamer. Born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Roman Catholic nun Sister Helen Prejean kind of stumbled into becoming the spiritual advisor to a death row inmate. She became famous after the publication of her book about that and subsequent experience, Dead Man Walking, and the release of the film starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn based on her book. Sister Helen last spoke on Tell Somebody in 2007, shortly after the release of her second book, The Death of Innocence. I spoke to her again on Friday, October 30, 2015, at Abilene University in South Kansas City, Missouri. Sister Helen Prejean, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Tom.
On my show last week, it was about a memorial at Rocky Flats, Colorado, to recognize the plutonium plant there and workers who got sick. And I talked to Kristen Iverson, who is author of a wonderful book about that. And in getting ready for the show, I was looking through her blog, and she was describing when she was interviewed on the radio show that Dr. Helen Caldicott does, and how Dr. Caldicott was a hero of hers. And bear with me, I haven't edited this question in my mind, and that led me to go back and listen. I had the great pleasure of meeting Dr. Caldicott, and then she sat at my dining room table and did an interview. And listening to it, I heard myself asking her about a note in her autobiography, a blurb by Sister Helen Prejean, who said something to the effect she learned from Dr. Caldicott how one set on fire person could change the world, or something to that effect. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
I remember writing that because I heard her speak at the University of New Orleans when she's a physician, and she left her physician's job because she was so concerned about the whole nuclear proliferation and the safety of children and all of us. And I remember hearing her talk, and that was the first time I awakened to the danger of this spreading of nuclear weapons. And I remember writing, because I got inspired when I wrote the blurb for her book about she blew on the coals of my soul, blew me bright awake. I still remember the words. And that she's an example of what we do with each other. We awaken each other to something that maybe we'd been unawake about, and she changed my life on the nuclear issue for sure.
Well, a lot of people look at some of these big problems and say, nothing I can do, it's leave it to the big people.
Yeah, we have a proliferation of information out there on all kinds of things, and your mind could just be loaded with trivia, and we feel paralyzed. A lot of times, our biggest problem is that people feel overwhelmed. They know of big problems in the world, and you just feel paralyzed by it. And until I started being active, see, the minute you take that first action of something that you believe is wrong and needs to be changed, it's liberating to act. And I found that once I began to act, once I began to write that letter to a congressperson, or once I got out there and we began to organize in Louisiana to do things to awaken the citizens about executions, you feel freed by that. The worst paralysis is not doing anything.
Listening to some of your old interviews on Democracy Now! Audio of some of your speeches and our last interviews 8 years ago or whenever it was, it strikes me that there's really not much new in terms of the broad issue. Something new. I mean, there's a lot of specifics in the landscape.
Breaking on the shore, there's tremendous newness going on around the death penalty. First of all, when you look at the polls, it just shows that the number of people now who, when you ask them on the up-down question, do you favor the death penalty for somebody who's done a horrific crime, found guilty, it's down to 56% from 64% just a few years ago. And we also see a difference in those opinion polls of the ferocity with which people believe in the death penalty. That has just really gone down. Used to be, I feel very strongly, now it's really weakened much more. The other thing is there's much more awareness of mistakes now. There are 156 wrongfully convicted people have gotten off of death row. And people have heard the stories, mistake after mistake after mistake. So people now, and I was an example when I first got involved in the 80s with people on death row. I thought we had the best court system in the world. And I thought, especially when it came to death, you have all these appeals. They're bound to catch mistakes if they did make mistakes at the trial. Then I began to learn that when you don't have a good attorney, and that attorney at your trial does not raise formal objections to the jury that sat or the prosecution hiding evidence or whatever, the appeals courts have nothing to look at, and you just slide right down the tracks and you can go and be executed. So there's much more awareness now in the country about the brokenness of the death penalty. Support began to go down in 2001 after Governor George Ryan in Illinois, after 13 innocent people were brought into his governor's office, looked at the whole system, declared it broken, and commuted the sentences. And from 2001 on, you can just see executions are down. The practice of executions are down across the United States. Texas used to do 48 executions or death sentences a year, and now they're down to 2 or 1. And then in the last 8 years, you've had state after state repeal the death penalty. New Mexico, Connecticut, Nebraska, Illinois, New York, New Jersey. And you can just see them coming down. You can see a trend which seems irreversible because we're much more savvy now. When we started out with the guidelines the Supreme Court gave us, that it's only to be for the worst of the worst, and they were going to leave states in charge of it. Well, everybody thought, well, yeah, that'll work. But see, when you leave states in charge of punishing criminals, even with death, it's finally up to the discretion of an individual prosecutor whether or not to go for death. So Missouri exemplifies what you see in Oklahoma, what we've seen in Texas. You get a rabid prosecutor who wants to cut notches on his belt, or in the case of a woman, Lynn Abraham in Philadelphia, who went for the death penalty every chance she could. So you have them in charge of going for the death penalty, so you have these pockets out of which the death penalty comes in the state. And here in Missouri, it's clearly St. Louis County, and there are two other counties. 2% of the counties represent more than 50% of all the death row inmates. And right next to them could be a county that never seeks the death penalty. So on the front door of the Supreme Court, you have the sign, equal justice under law, and you leave it up to discretion of prosecutors. And so people are beginning to see the unevenness of it. And you can have a prosecutor who wants to make a political career for himself or herself. And the other thing that people are saying is that the botched executions, because the Supreme Court has been allowing states to experiment with putting together any concoction of drugs, not saying where they got them, and experimenting on killing people. So you had Clayton Lockett, who struggled for 45 minutes until they stopped the execution. Then he died of a heart attack. One journalist wrote about it. They killed Clayton Lockett while they were trying to execute him. They were so inept. Somebody had misplaced the IV kit. They were trying to inject him with those drugs, and they were putting it into the muscle. There's no transparency about what states are doing. The Veterinarian Association in euthanizing animals has more monitoring and transparency than we have for the killing of human beings. And that's all in the laps of the Supreme Court that has allowed this to happen. So we're hearing about botched executions. Richard Glossop's case, I was involved with it. It made news around the world. It was on global social networks that, you know, Richard Branson for Virgin Airlines got involved. Pope Francis sent a letter to the governor because he was a man.
Give us, for some of us that haven't kept up, some more details about that case.
Yeah, Richard Glossop is a man, solely on the word of another man, Justin Sneed, who admitted, confessed, that he had killed somebody while he was attempting to rob him, implicated Richard Glossop at the suggestion of the police detectives, as is evident now from the video confession, that the police detectives introduced Richard Glossop into the scenario. And then the one aggravating circumstance that could give Richard Glossop the death penalty, though there was no forensic evidence, no physical evidence to back up that Justin Sneed said that Richard Glossop had masterminded it, the whole murder, that brought him right to the jaws of death three times, very close. And there, when you look at that picture, there's always this chemistry in it. A rabid prosecutor, Bob Macy, who had gotten 54 death penalties in Oklahoma County, totally inept defense that doesn't cross-examine people like Justin Sneed and show that he's impeached his credibility. And they had ample evidence that he was changing the version eight times of what he gave, but they hadn't done their homework. They hadn't done their investigation. And the defense clearly was cowed by the prosecution, started just not raising any objections, and they just mowed over them. And so Richard Glossop, on the lie of this man, and then it gets thicker because the prosecution has threatened him with death himself. And Justin Sneed was a 19-year-old kid who was a heavy meth addict, and they're threatening him with death. And then you can just see how you get false confessions. You threaten a 19-year-old with the death penalty himself. Then you begin, and you can see this in the police detectives, questions to him. Oh, well, you know, we don't believe you did this alone, Justin. Oh, you know, we've arrested Richard Glossop. We think. And Justin Sneed then sees a path. This is how I get out of the death penalty. They want me to start talking about Richard Glossop. So, boy, he cooperates. He gives eight different versions of everything Richard Glossop and how he masterminded it. And because money was involved in the robbery, murder for hire, that's an aggravating circumstance. You could get the death penalty. So Justin Sneed is now serving a life sentence in a medium security prison. The saying is that he got a long sentence on a soft yard. It's one of the best prisons you'd want to be in Oklahoma. And Richard Glossop is actually facing death. And if there hadn't been this mounting of worldwide opinion of people seeing and watching this case, for sure they would have killed Richard Glossop on September 30th. Just as they killed Charles Warner with the wrong drug, which later was, there was an autopsy done of Charles Warner's body, and really good journalists got freedom of information and sued the state to get the emails to show all the conversations that were going on, that they were aware that they were using this potassium acetate, which is not an approved drug, and hiding it. And all that was coming out. And then with Richard, because there was such world attention to Richard Glossop's case, they didn't dare do that to him because they knew this potassium acetate, as it turned out, was what they were about to use for his execution too, that there would have been an autopsy and the whole world would have heard about it. So poor Charles Warner, because he didn't have the public attention, they sent that man to his death. When they started injecting him, he's yelling out, "I got fire, I got acid in my veins." They were using this drug, potassium acetate, as it was later shown from the autopsy, that they used to use to embalm people with. It changes the liquid composition of the blood. And we have no way of getting any transparency. There's no accountability thus far in the states who are experimenting with the killing of human beings. So when Richard Glossop's execution was stopped, and then it's just everything blew up. I mean, it was like everything started coming out about the autopsy of Charles Warner, the man before Richard Glossop. They'd used the wrong drug on him. They looked at the vials that they had for the execution of Charles Warner. They had lied on the syringes. They had potassium chloride, which is the usual drug you use to kill people. But on the vials, they found potassium acetate. So they were lying. And they lied to the Supreme Court in the Glossop v. Gross case about what drugs were being used for executions. They had something that they presented to the court as a letter from a pharmaceutical company that was telling them, because of the pressure put on them by abolitionists, they were being pressured not to be able to send the drug they had been sending that had been used as the anesthetic. But actually, the journalists found out that that letter from that pharmaceutical company had been sent to Texas, not to the Oklahoma Department of Corrections. And they had blotted out, Texas is a little word, they had blotted that out and put in Oklahoma Department of Corrections. And that was in an exhibit they presented before the Supreme Court of the United States.
Wow.
I just read today, it was just announced, that Anita Trammell, who's been the warden at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister, has retired. She's quitting. I've heard the governor has a lawyer. I've heard the Department of Corrections has a lawyer. So good journalists make a big difference in getting the truth out to citizens. And I'm very grateful to them for what they did in Richard's case.
Indeed.
Yes.
Any time this comes up, I often think about the presidential debate with Dukakis, and I guess it was Elder Bush, and this kind of gotcha question, you know, if somebody raped or murdered your wife, and Dukakis gave a very rational, I didn't think in a lot of ways such a bad answer, but obviously bad how it could be
got
spun.
It, yeah.
And I always thought, he should have said, if they did that to my wife, I would want to stick my hand down their throat and pull their heart out and anything I could do to give them the experience.
I wish they had asked you the question.
But is that how we want our whole system to be?
Exactly.
And you've gotten a lot of criticism from certain, not all by any means, murder victim families. Why are you worrying about these guys?
The poor murderer. She's going to hold the poor murderer's hand. Look what happened to our daughter. Look what happened to my father. Why doesn't she support the death penalty? Because look what happened to them. And that formula leads to, I think, the moral destruction and the caliber of our very soul. I feel bad for victims' families because I think they're manipulated by prosecutors, that the only way to do justice for a victim's family is to do to the criminal what the criminal did to their loved one, which means to kill them, and then that we're going to invite the victim's family to go send a representative to watch the state kill. When New Jersey, 9 years ago, the legislature did away with the death penalty, 62 murder victims' families testified saying, don't kill for us. The death penalty just re-victimizes us, puts us in a holding pattern of waiting for this closure, this justice that never happens.
Sister Helen Prejean, thank you very much for talking to us
again, Tom.
On Tell Somebody.
It's always a joy. Thank you.
A couple of hours after our conversation, Sister Helen Prejean addressed an audience at Unity on the Plaza in Kansas City, Missouri. Tune in to Tell Somebody on KKFI next Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear what she had to say.
Okay, y'all, I'm from the South. We tell stories, and boy, am I having stories. Stories about justice, stories about small groups of individuals like Missourians against for alternatives to the death penalty, beginning to stand up and educate the public and change things.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.